Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Take a trip down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be. Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear as PSP rides again. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium with your hosts, Mike Norris, Jerry Oates, and Bobby Simmons.
All right, it's Thursday. Time for Peach State Pandemonium. What's up, guys?
I'm doing good.
Yeah. I'm good.
That's good. That's good.
Well, I'm just a flattering intro, man. That was kind of flat there. me and Jerry live off this. You know, we wait every week to, you know.
I thought he was going to really build us up, Bobby.
Yeah, what's you know.
You guys didn't tell me what intro music you wanted to use this week.
Maybe that's what did it.
And there's a coordinate against shooting off firearms inside the city limits, so I can't do that.
But Bobby and I will take what we can get, Mike.
What's that?
I said Bobby and I will take what we can get.
Yes, we will.
In lieu of pay, right?
Oh, the check's not in the mail?
I don't need to mail them. I can throw them and they'll bounce all the
time. I understand.
We were talking just before we went on the air, Bobby. What's the latest you've heard on Bill Dromo?
I talked to him Tuesday night in a hospital, and he's in for pneumonia, and he said that they were going to do 2 or 3 days of breathing treatments and some antibiotics, and hopefully he would be home by the weekend. He was in real good spirits, and he sounded good, so he was very positive and upbeat. So hopefully he's going to be up, Adam, and back at the wonderful Dromo estate maybe by Saturday.
I'm sure if the nurses and doctors have anything to do with it, they'll get him out of there as quick as they can, because I'm sure he's still fit.
Well, he is mellowed now as he's gotten a little older.
Yeah, but he's still stiff.
Well, that's, you know.
One shot across the back, whether he means it or not, it hurts. A couple other things I wanted to mention. I don't know if you guys are familiar with the name. I think, Bobby, you may have probably met her somewhere along the line. So from what I understand, she used to attend the reunions here in Mobile as Venus LaRue, or Penny LaRue, who was at one time married to Chief Little Evil. Had gotten word from her. She has been diagnosed with terminal cancer, and she has less than 6 months to live.
God love her.
So, you guys keep praying your thoughts and prayers. Have either one of you guys ever met her?
I met her at the reunion one year. She came by. She didn't stay long, but she came by. Her son now, what's his name, Cornell?
Yeah, I think that is.
I'm pulling, trying to get a name out of there. Cornell sounds right. He was a regular at the reunion for a few years. But that's, I know Charlie worked with Little Eagle a lot. He may be much more familiar with her than I am.
You know, she wrestled too.
Yeah.
Like I think she was actually in the business is how they met, because she's from Pensacola originally. Of course, Little Eagle worked down here for several years, and I'm not sure if he ever booked this territory like he did Georgia or not, but I know he spent a lot of time in here. And I believe she is living here in Mobile now, but I'm not positive on that. And there's also a gentleman that, again, that I had heard of and was aware of him, but met him through the Gulf Coast reunion. Is a gentleman by the name of Mike Hendricks, who was one of that gang that grew up with Michael Hayes and Robert Gibson and Percy and all those. He's probably was or his one of Percy's closest friends. They were childhood friends. Mike's from here in Mobile, but he worked here a little bit. He worked for Billis and up throughout Tennessee for a while. But anyway, he has been diagnosed with congestive heart failure. He's had like 6 or 8 heart attacks within the last couple of years. And, so just want to keep him in our thoughts and prayers as well. Our brotherhood doesn't need to dwindle down any more than it already has if we can possibly keep it from happening.
Well, it doesn't look good, does it?
No. No, unfortunately. And Mike is probably my age, maybe a year or two older than me. Percy's your age, isn't he, Bobby?
We're close. I'm not sure how old Bill is. He just had a birthday, I think.
Yeah, this past Sunday, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, but I'm not sure.
But anyway, just want to keep those two and their thoughts, or their family and friends, in our thoughts and prayers, and let's give them comfort for their pain and pull them through if we can. Our brotherhood and sisterhood gets smaller every year by leaps and bounds. We need to do something to stem the tide a little bit. It's been a bad couple of years here.
It has that.
I don't even like to think about it. I get depressed.
I almost switched something to it.
Yeah.
What I wanted us to talk about tonight was the NWA World Heavyweight Championship, back when it was still the NWA World Heavyweight Championship. Of course, Luthez was the first unified and fully recognized NWA champion, but Orville Brown was actually the very first NWA champion. They were supposed to, from what history says, that they were supposed to have a unification match, because at the time, Fez was the also an NWA champion, but he was the National Wrestling Association, which was a spinoff of the National Boxing Association at that time. And Brown was the National Wrestling Alliance champion. They were due to have a unification match in November of 49, and Orville Brown was severely injured in a car wreck and never wrestled again. So Fez ended up with it by default. I know both of you have been in the ring. You've actually traded holds with him, Jerry. What was that like?
Luthez?
Yes, sir.
I only wrestled him one time, and I was partners with him another time. I wrestled him in like 1971. Excuse me, hadn't been in the business hardly any time, and it was at TV in Atlanta. And when they come to me and told me I was wrestling Luthez, I was just, you know, in a panic. You know, you heard stories about how, you know, happy really was, and they told me, said, I think I've told this story before, they said, when he goes for that double wrist lock, that ain't no joke, and it wasn't. Boy, he took me over, and you know, it was just, I'm just glad to say that I got to have the honor to wrestle him. Well, got guzzled by Luthez, but yeah. I mean, he was salty. I mean, you know, he would be on you, man. I mean, he didn't lay back. And then the only other time I was ever in the ring with him, it was when I had my first knee surgery in 76. I was out for 9 weeks, and my first time back, I did Atlanta TV that morning. I did Columbus TV that afternoon. By that night, my knee had swollen back up, you know, and I was panicking because I was leaving the next week dead and I was going to Japan. And Luthez and I were partners in Griffin, Georgia on that Saturday night in the Valiant, Jimmy and Johnny. And That was a thrill knowing I didn't have to go against being my partner. And I remember both of those matches just like it was yesterday, knowing I was, you know, had the honor, because I thought he wasn't the only one. He was one of the ones that carried himself and represented our business the way it should have been done.
Amen.
That's my opinion.
I've said a lot of times, if I had to pick two guys that were the epitome of what I think our business should be and the way someone conducts and carries themselves, it would Luthez, and I'd also say Nick Bockwinkel. They both just carried themselves, and of course Nick still does. You know, he carries himself very well. He's very well spoken, and it's just a, you know, we got too many guys out there in flip flops and cut off shorts and
come on, man.
You know, I mean,
anytime, and I was around Luthez many times, just like you were too, Bobby. You know, and when he walked in, it's not. I mean, it was like, you know, whether he had the title or didn't, it was like, God, a champ here. I mean, he just carried himself, and he respected what he did that much, and he gave that much respect back to it.
Yes, he did.
That's what I saw from him.
He did.
And you know, he was a great representative of being a world champion. And, you know, and people today, that, you know, they don't even respect themselves, how they go respect our business. You know.
And Bobby, did you ever wrestling or referee any of this match?
No, I never wrestled him. I refereed several matches he was in, and I worked with him. I worked with him a little bit when I was working for Ann. Not only, actually in '85 when I went back to work with her when she tried to do the little thing in '85, Lou was trying to run some tapes and some shows overseas. Might have been India or somewhere, but I kind of got to work with him in putting some TVs together and stuff.
He was a good commentator too, Bobby.
Yes, he was. Yes, he was. And the thrill for me, I mean, and this may sound silly to everybody else, but to me it was a thrill that he called me by my first name. I mean, as a kid growing up, you know, he was the man. And that title meant something. And when he come through town defending that title, you know, you actually thought, hey, this guy's, you know. And then as you learned about him and you got in the and I got in the business, I mean, it was just a thrill to me that I was on a first-name basis with him.
I never saw him be a jerk or a wise guy to anybody, no matter what their position was on the card or their experience in the business. I never saw that.
No, I didn't either.
So that's the, I never had the pleasure of meeting him. He, I was so looking forward to my first reunion here, come down here, because I know he came to the reunions here, but unfortunately he got sick and passed away before the first reunion. I came down in 2002. But that's everything I'd ever heard about him was he always, you know, made the rounds, and when he hit the arena, you know, he'd make the rounds in the dressing room to introduce himself to each and every person like they didn't know who he was, and just carried himself, you know, as the epitome of what the wrestling business was. But people don't realize that Fez, because he was champion when television first came on. A lot of people talk about how popular Gorgeous George was, and you know how he was the big name in the early 50s on the television boom. But Fez was the wrestling business. He was, at that time, I think he was living in Los Angeles, and was very close friends with a lot of Hollywood stars like Burt Lancaster and people like that. That he was close friends with, and he mingled with a lot of big name people. So, entertainers hanging around with wrestlers is not something new. It's something that Luthez was very well known for.
But if there's ever anybody that loved the business, it was him.
Well, absolutely, absolutely. That's everything I've heard about him. And of course, he had a very long time around. You know, he was always billed as being the six-time world heavyweight champion, which he was, but what most people don't realize, he only held the National Wrestling Alliance title three times. His first run was right at 7 years when he dropped it to Billy Watson. Don't know if either one of you ever have worked around Billy Watson, seen him wrestle or anything else, but he was Canadian wrestling what at least Eastern Canadian, or Canada, I should say. He was to Canada, at least that part, what Fez was in the United States. He was just an absolute legend.
And, yeah, I never met him.
The top draw in Toronto forever and ever. And I really, you know, I don't want to say he was, even though he only held the title for about 8 months, I wouldn't really consider him a transition champion because the title went right back to Fez, you know, after 8 months. I think that may have been a point where Watson was just, because he was so well known throughout Canada and everything, that was just an opportunity for the title go up there, even though he did travel throughout the United States with it, just like the traveling champion did. And I think that's what, you know, a lot of people talk about the various championships that there were. That's what made the NWA championship up to a point the true championship, because, I mean, this champion went to not only all the territories here, but they went to Australia, New Zealand, Japan. I think Fez, when he held the title, went to England, went into Mexico, and and this is no knock on the other titles that eventually spun off, the AWA and the WWWF, and at one point there was WWA in California, also WWA in Indianapolis, NWF in Northern New York, but those were all, you know, company titles to me.
They're just regional champions, you know.
Exactly. You know, they called themselves world champions, you know, they didn't travel any. You know, they defended against company champions or company opponents, guys who worked for all the same promoter. And that was, to me, is what made the NWA special, and that's what the whole idea was to begin with. Of course, you know, all the guys that held that up until, you know, the mid-80s, that's what they did. They traveled. And they hit every little town and every little territory. I don't think there was a territory during the course of any champion's turn that didn't get to see the champion at least once. And, of course, once he got it back from Watson, he held it for another year, and then dropped it to Dick Hutton. And Dick Hutton is somebody that a lot of people overlook because he was a well-known amateur and was trained by Strangler Lewis and Leroy McGurk, so he had a good professional training background. But because he was not real flashy and not real colorful and everything, he didn't seem to be a very big draw. And he didn't hold the title but a little over a year, and then dropped to Pat O'Connor. I know, Jerry, I know you worked with Pat O'Connor.
Many times.
As much as you spent time in Kansas City, I know you worked with him. What was he like in that?
Pat was, I'll never forget the first time I ever worked with him. I had a headlock on him. He blew me up with me holding a headlock on him. If you can fathom that. No, really, I'm not kidding you. I'm not kidding
what
you.
What was
he? He'd have the side headlock on him, take him over on the side, headlock takeover. He'd roll you on your back. He'd throw that arm around, boom, you're right back up on your feet, boom, take him over again. I mean, it was just, he'd head scissor you out, he'd get you in a head scissor, you'd kick out, boom, head scissor again. I mean, side headlock takeover again. And it's just, I mean, in 5 minutes, I couldn't breathe. He's laughing the whole time. But I enjoyed being in the ring with Pat. I really did. He was he had his style, you know, and that's okay, because I kind of considered myself, you know, I felt like I could work with just about anybody. If that was his style, then you go with it, you know. And he was a pleasure. He was different, but he was a pleasure. But he'd work you over. I think if you ask anybody that's ever worked with him, I'll tell you the same thing.
Because if I'm not mistaken, he was a shooter as well, because he came...
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
He got an amateur background in New Zealand, which is where he's from originally.
Yeah, Pat could handle himself. If you want a quick story on Pat O'Connor, I'll give you one. They had a Kansas City, you know, it was in its day, back in the day, you know, it was gangsters and all like this. So my wife had flown to Savannah, and I was out there in Kansas City. Ted was in Japan, and so we were wrestling Kansas City on a Thursday night, and O'Connor said, "Hey, what you doing tonight?" I said, "Nothing. Let's go out to eat." I said, "Okay." So I went out to eat with Pat, and we go in this restaurant and sit down. He said, "You see that guy right there? That's so-and-so." Really, you know, one of the people, you know. And then we went to like a little bar, and he said, "You see that guy over there? That's so-and-so." And everybody knew him. Everybody knew him. So about a month later, Pat, after the matches, was down at a place about downtown Kansas City. It was called Sunderson. It was a little diner right downtown. And he was sitting there with his girl eating. So this guy reaches across Pat and gets a French fry off this girl he's with's plate. O'Connor looked at him. The guy did it again. So Pat says, "Don't do that again." Of course, Pat's using his way of talking. The guy did it again. Pat invited the guy out on the sidewalk. As soon as the guy walked out, Pat gave him a belly-to-back suplex on the sidewalk. Bob Geigel gets a call the next morning. "This is so-and-so." "Good." Now, I'm talking about a mafia guy now. It's a mafia guy. He said, Bob. "Yeah, hey. They never told me the name. He said, "Everything's cool," said Pat Suplex, one of the big man's son on the sidewalk last night, but he said, "Tell Pat everything's cool," because he knows how his son is. That's what Pat was. He didn't care who the guy was. Some mafia guy's son, he suplexed him. Oh, God. But then they had heard the story. It was like, "God, I was just out with this guy about a month ago at night, you know. I had nothing to do with it, guys. Believe me." All those people knew him and Geigel. They all knew him. And that's my one story for the night on Pat O'Connor.
Now, did he owned a part of that territory, didn't he?
Yeah, it was him, Geigel, and Harley.
Harley. I think O'Connor had some points in the St. Louis office as well.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. Yes, sir, he did. He booked St. Louis.
Okay, that's right.
The greatest wrestling town. Probably the greatest wrestling town I had ever been in. I mean, they took care of that town.
That's what I've always heard, because St. Louis really wasn't a territory. But they would pull in top names, and of course, with much like the NWA presence for many years, he had his choice of guys that he could bring in and showcase. Can you imagine? And wrestling at the Chase, had it been able to be on cable, like the Georgia show?
If it was unreal, I mean, you'd show up in St. Louis, and you know, I know the first time I went to St. Louis, I mean, I was in awe. You know? Wilbur Snyder was there. Dick the Bruiser was there. Then they would bring guys out of Ganya's territory like Mulligan and Lanza, Tara. There would be some guys from Florida, be some guys from Atlanta. I mean, it was they protected that town. That town was, they ran it right, you know. And I did get a main event shot there. I mean, you know, they bring in guys in all over. I've worked on a double main event. I worked with it was me and Harley, one main event, and the other main event was Bruno and Murdoch. So I was pleased to have that honor.
Bobby, did you deal with O'Connor?
Is that when St. Louis started dying shortly after that, or was
2 weeks later?
I'm sorry. Set him up, and I'll knock him out.
2 weeks later.
Never had the privilege of working with O'Connor at all.
You didn't?
I met him, but I never was in the ring with him.
Did you ever have any dealings with him office-wise?
No.
Him being the poker
no, player? No. No, if you called out there to do anything, you dealt with Geigel. And I dealt with Bob quite a bit when he was president of the NWA, and of course Barnett was the secretary treasurer. There was a lot of times I would be the middleman on some phone calls, but I never actually. Well, I met him when he would come into Atlanta TV every once in a while as president of the NWA. But last year at Cauliflower Alley, that's the first time I had seen him in 25 years. But
Bob was a great guy.
Yes. Yes. You know, you go back, I just want to throw something in here. You were talking about Fez when he dropped the title for 8 months to Watson. When Barnett was Secretary Treasurer of the NWA, he booked the champion. And, of course, with him booking a champion, I usually typed the booking sheets, and the territories would pay, a percentage when they used the champion for each town that he was in. I think it was 3% or was supposed to be 3%, and it came in, and I kept the checkbook for the NWA, and it was part of what I did. But what I wanted to say is when Fez had that title, and you're talking about how he went to all these different territories, being the NWA world champion wasn't all the glamour that everybody thinks it might have been. He would work. It was not uncommon for the champion to work 50 weeks a year. And those off days wouldn't come every 2 weeks together. They would be one here and one 3 months later and one 6 months later and two here and two there. I mean, it was a horrible, grueling routine. And in the days of Thez, when he first got it, the guys were still driving a lot. They were traveling by train. It was a tough way to make a living. I can remember hearing Bockwinkel tell the story one time about he was approached about being the NWA champion. And I don't remember who he said approached him. But he said he looked at what the NWA champion made against how much he traveled. He said then he looked at what he made working for Gagne in the AWA and being at home at night. And he said he turned it down. He didn't want any part of it. And he said it was just, he said, of course, the champion made a lot of money. He said, but he earned every dime of it.
Yes, they did.
And I agree. I agree. I know when Harley got the title, the might have been the second time he got it, one of the things that they tried to work, they would work a month and get a week off. They started trying to book the champion that way. And, I mean, it was just, you'd look at that book and, I mean, you know, you, let's just, I mean, Jerry's worked in Texas. He knows what the trips in Texas was like. You know, the champion goes up there and spends a week in Texas. Well, he may fly into Dallas to start or fly into Houston and work Friday night, but the rest of the week he's in the car with somebody making those trips.
Sure. They made trips just like the rest of us.
Yes, sir. And then you fly out and, you know, he didn't go home and stay a week. He would fly out of there and he would go to Calgary and work a week, or he would fly to Kansas City and work a week, or you know where. I mean, it was a grueling. It's great to have that strap. It's great to be the world champion, but buddy, I'm telling you, they tell me that Dory developed a little bit of a heart problem because of the stress and the travel that he was under. It's so much for your family life if you got that belt.
Yeah, I know, Jack.
What you about the scheduling thing? I think they had actually tried to start that. That's what they had promised Briscoe. And that's why he decided to give it up after only having, you know, a couple of years, because it was like, you know, because what they had promised him, he'd end up working anyway. On the weeks he was scheduled off, you know, somebody need a, you know, their town was down, they need the champion to come in to pop the territory or whatever, and he would end up getting talked into doing that. And he never got his time. He said after 2.5 years, he was just exhausted, and he was ready to give him the belt back.
Well, he told me himself it's not what people think. I know I was going to work with him one night in Des Moines, Iowa, and he had come in that day. Well, he didn't get there till like 9:30 that night. He told me he left there about 9 o'clock to get to Portland, to Des Moines. He had to go here, yonder, everywhere. And when he walked in the dressing room, he said, "I'm physically exhausted." You know, he's been flying all day trying to get there, you know, and then it was a grind. It was a grind. But you know, 2 years out of your whole life, and I know Jack made plenty of money, Harley made plenty of money with it, and I know Dory made big money for even in the late 60s when he first got it. That's a short time, you know, to me.
Yeah.
That would be a short time to me for what the benefits, if you carried yourself right and did the right things, you know, you'd be rewarded down the road with it too, but.
Do you guys know about the near plane crash that Briscoe was in, don't you?
No.
It was he was supposed to be flying into Mobile. He was working with Ken Lucas, and they announced about midway through the card here that he would not make it. The plane he was on had landing gear problems, and they had to, I don't remember where it was he was flying out of or flying from to come into Mobile, but they had to turn around, and they did a belly landing, and so, you know, spending that much time on an airplane, you're against the odds anyway.
Exactly, and as much as they were flying.
And, of course, after O'Connor came Buddy Rose, Buddy Rogers, who had been a couple of promoters, mainly Vince McMahon Sr. and Fred Kohler of Chicago, were pushing to have him be the world champion prior to Fez even losing the title to Watson. And Fez, from what I understand, refused to drop it to him. Mushnick was against it because they were so afraid, since he was such so indebted to McMahon and Kohler, that the rest of the territories would never see the champion. But they decided after O'Connor had had the title 2 years to go ahead and put it on Rogers, and lo and behold, that's exactly what happened. He worked New York, he worked Washington, D.C., he worked Chicago, and worked very few other places as far as defending the title. And no matter how they tried to get him to drop the title or bring the title to somewhere else, he wouldn't do it. He only worked for those. Of course, I'm sure he was making more money in those places, but he wouldn't say go to Atlanta or go to from the Mobile or go any place like that. And so I don't think Fez had any intentions of having the title back again, but he was talked into coming back and basically taking it off Rogers. Whether he agreed to drop or not, he was going to lose the title. So that was what that was all about. And of course, that led to the convention of the Worldwide Wrestling Federation, and him being named, Buddy Rogers being named their first champion, and of course that paved the way for Bruno Sammartino. And the birth of what we've seen nowadays.
Well, I heard, I mean, you know, Kerry, again, you know how things, I mean, I don't know exactly what was said, but I heard Fez told Rogers we could do this the easy way or we can do this the hard way. It's entirely up to you.
I'll give Rogers credit. He looked like a champion.
Yes, he did.
Oh yeah.
How he had a tan like he had. No sunbeds or nothing then. I only saw him in person one time. I saw him in Charlotte. I was 12 years old. He was world champion. And when Ted and I was at TV, and he come walking out, man, I flipped out. I've never seen a guy look like that. Golden brown. And you know something Rogers did every night? He put in new shoelaces every night. I mean, he was immaculate. He was immaculate. He looked like a champion.
And, he gets knocked a lot and stuff, but I think I've got quite a lot of videotape on him. I think he's a great worker. He was a great heel. He was, as far as getting heat, and he didn't have to do much. Just walk out there with that look on his face, and he drew all heat. So that was what he was paid to do. And you could see where he would have his fans, too, because I know when I said to last week that Buddy Rogers was his idol, and I can see where he would be, because like Jerry said, he looked like a wrestler. He looked like a champion. He carried himself like a champion.
Frankie King told me they was in New York, and he said he was sitting in a restaurant eating. He said Rogers walks in. He had that swagger. I mean, that was just a natural way with him. He just had that. He said people stopped eating and looked at him, not necessarily knowing who he was, but they. Frankie said they knew he was somebody. They didn't know who he was, but he was somebody. He just carried himself like that. He was immaculate.
Another guy that was like that was Blassie.
Yes.
When Freddie Blassie walked in somewhere, people stopped what they were doing.
I can imagine. I was never around Blassie, even never. I've seen videotape on it, and I've been for everything, but I can imagine.
I saw him wrestle a lot of times as a kid, in different situations. I saw him before I started going to the matches. They said one of the greatest feuds they ever had in the city of Atlanta was Blassie and Gunkel. And then of course I seen Blassie and as a heel. I saw him as a babyface here in Atlanta in different, as I say, different scenarios. But the only time I ever actually met him, he came into the Omni one time on a show managing. I think he was managing Nikolai Volkoff. I can't remember, but he came in from New York, and I went over. You talk about a mark. I went over in the dressing room and introduced myself and sat down. And I said, man. I said, I just want to sit down and talk to you a minute. I said, and I explained, I said, I'm not trying to be funny. I said, when I was a kid, and, he was the nicest fella I think I've ever met in my life. And he was asking me questions about things in Atlanta. And, Jerry, I don't know if you ever ate at this place, but over by the sports arena, there was a restaurant over there called Mammy's Kitchen.
Yes.
And they had, like biscuits and gravy and, that sort of stuff. And the first thing he asked me, he says, is Mammy's Kitchen still there? I mean, he remembered, all his years here. He just, but what a nice guy.
He spent a lot of time in Atlanta, man.
Yes, he did. He lived here for a long time.
Yeah, lived there for a long time.
Yeah.
Sold cars there.
When he lost the kidney, he went to work for Al Means Ford here in Atlanta, selling cars. And then, of course, that lasted about 6 months, and he was back in the ring working again.
Well, guys, we've got a couple of callers. I'm going to take a break real quick, and we come back, we'll take a couple of phone calls. So hang in there. We'll be right back.
All right.
You're listening to the GWH Radio Network, brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Your show will return momentarily. Did you know that there's more to GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com than just Georgia wrestling history? It's true. Not only can you find documented cards, results, and more on pro wrestling in Georgia dating back to the 19th century, but you can also find out where live and local wrestling may be near you today, and not just in Georgia. We also cover the southeastern regional scene in Alabama, Florida, Tennessee, and the Carolinas. You want more? Well, we also cover the major worldwide wrestling and MMA promotions as well, including WWE, UFC, TNA, Strikeforce, Ring of Honor, and more. And so do our radio shows. You can find all of this and maybe a bit more by logging on to GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com, where we are capturing the legends of yesterday and covering the stars of today. GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com.
All right. Steven, we've got on the line here with us. Call from area code 910. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey.
Hey.
Can you guys hear me?
Oh, yeah.
My name's Sean.
Hey, Sean. Welcome to P-State Pandemonium.
Well, it's my first time calling it, but I listen to you guys every week, man, and I thoroughly enjoy the show. Growing up, I always wanted to be a pro wrestler, so that didn't work out for me, and I'm living my life vicariously through your stories. It's been really great. Yeah, you were talking about the World Championship. I remember when Briscoe was champion. Of course, he had the plane crash here in Wilmington that took down Ric Flair, Johnny Valentine, and Tim Woods was out of action, Bob Brothers. And in order to keep Jim Crockett floating, you know, Briscoe had to come in and make during when he was supposed to be off, would have to come in here and wrestle just to keep the houses up, you know. And I'm sure he was getting that, and not just him, but all the rest of the champions, you know, when they had scheduled time off, all the promoters were, wanting to use him as much as they could. So I can see how, like you say, they might get 2 weeks off in a year. But then I remember reading, I think it was in Ole's book, where if he had to book the champion, he didn't want to book him in Atlanta, in the big cities. They'd book him in the small towns because he was getting so much a percentage of the gate. So it wasn't all that flashy to be the NWA champion. In Flair's book, he was talking about having to defend the NWA title in the parking lot of a car dealership while the kids watched and the salesman tried to sell a Cadillac or something. It's not really that flashy like everybody would thought it would have been. But, I just wanted to, I had some time, I want to give you guys a call and tell you how much I enjoy the show.
We're appreciative of that.
Yeah, we do. Sean, this is Bobby.
Yes.
Bobby. Let me tell you what the NWA bylaws said. The bylaws said that the world champion, if he wrestled on a card, he was supposed to get 10% of the net house. That was whatever the gross was, less the sales tax, the champion was supposed to get 10%, and the NWA was supposed to get 3%. Now, if you paid it right by the book, that's 13% off the top of your house that goes to the champion. So that was the reason that Ole didn't like to use the champion, because Barnett, being the Secretary of Treasury of the National Wrestling Alliance, he pretty well adhered to that figure. And it could be very costly. I mean, on a $100,000 house at the Omni, you're talking $13,000 right off the top.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no question about it. I remember, reading in Ole's book where he was kind of dead set against it. Having to defend it in the smaller towns where it's not making that much of the gate.
Right.
Hey, guys, I know a while back you were talking about different territories or in Georgia other than NWA, and it was a series, you know, like 1 week you would cover this and that. There was one that I got on cable access when they first started running cable here was World League Wrestling. Lars Anderson ran it.
Oh, yeah.
They had Snake Brown and Steve Collins. Those are the only guys I can remember on the show. But
I think Mike Davis started with them.
Maybe so.
Isn't that what Mike Davis started with, Bobby?
Could have been. He had a guy that worked for him, too, that he called the Black Cowboy. He was a takeoff on Dusty. And the guy was actually, he worked at the Atlanta City Auditorium as one of the maintenance guys. And when Lars started the thing, he went over and enrolled in Lars' school. Next thing we know, he's on TV.
I thought I was going to die when I heard Jerry say one night that Snake Brown was to have a good match with him. I never saw that in him, Jerry.
Snake was better than what you thought.
Yes, he was.
Yeah, well.
Snake Brown could have made a lot of money in this business if he had just wanted to travel.
He's a nice guy.
He had a hell of a look.
Yes, yeah. He did.
Yeah, he had a hell of a look. He could probably draw some heat just from the way he looked. So.
But,
I guess there's a lot of those.
But to get
guys, we'll get off the phone.
Okay, we appreciate you calling in so much.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks a lot. All right, we'll see you.
Thanks, Sean.
But, you know, to get back to the world champion, you know, promoters, whether it was early or whoever, that didn't want to use the champion because of the cost. But, you know, if you had a great world champion, I mean, to me, it just added so much to your territory and to the guys that got the chance to wrestle him. But I'm sure if Ole had been the world champion, it would have been different.
Oh, I'm sure. And, you know, the thing, too, is this, from just a pure common sense standpoint, if Jerry Oates is my Georgia heavyweight champion and he's my top babyface and he's supposedly the best I've got in the state, I mean, it makes all the sense in the world that Jerry Oates would want to wrestle the world heavyweight champion to try to better himself. That's just common sense.
And business.
You know, and good business. The only drawback that you ever had, and I've seen this happen, you know, is number one, when the champion comes in, you know, if he's not going to, you know, and he's not going to drop the title, he's either got to beat your top babyface, you got to work some kind of deal where neither one of the champion or your top babyface doesn't get hurt or heal, whoever you got working with them, or they got to go an hour. And the sad part is there was a lot of guys, they couldn't have went an hour if you'd have gave them a motorcycle to do it on.
So then, in my opinion, they shouldn't have been in that spot anyway.
Yeah, I agree.
That's just me talking, and I know the first time I ever wrestled Briscoe, I went an hour with him in St. Joe, Missouri.
And I never wrestled an hour, but I refereed a lot of hours. And I know one night in Augusta, Georgia, there was a scale right there by the, as you come down the steps before you went down toward the ringer in Augusta, there was an old scale like in a doctor's office. And I weighed myself as I went to the ring that night. And I went in there, and whoever it was an hour under those lights. And, you know, the referee, he's not taking the bumps, but he's up and down and around just like everybody else is. When I came out that night, I weighed myself. I lost 9 pounds in an hour.
I believe it. And when they scream 45 minutes gone and 15 to go, you think you're going to lose your mind.
Your lungs are screaming.
That last 15 is when you got to start. I mean, I'm not saying you've been out there laying down. That last 15, especially if you're in there with a world champion, that's when you've got to kick it in gear.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And if you're in shape and you're in there with somebody that knows what they're doing, an hour, I've done many of them, and I know a squawker, they scream an hour on me. I didn't care. I didn't care. I just love what I was doing. I didn't care.
Yeah.
I didn't care.
Well, I'm going to get somebody else on the line with us that I know has been in the ring with some world champions. Let me get him on the line. Mr. Schmidt, you with us?
Yes, sir. Gentlemen, how are y'all tonight?
Great,
Julie.
Who
was the first world champion you refereed a match with? Strangler Lewis or Jim Lobbins?
Yeah. Jim Lobbins. Jerry Wrestling.
Charlie refereed when the Angel and Jacob had a Broadway there in the Bible.
Hey, when I started refereeing, 2 was the count.
Hey, Mike. Hey, excuse me. This is also a debut tonight. Mr. Smith has a hearing aid now. He can actually hear what we're saying, so we have to be real careful.
Yes, sir. If I'm not mistaken, Michael, Flair wrestled in St. Louis for the championship.
Dusty
Rhodes.
Oh, Dusty, yeah.
Didn't he win the championship in Kansas City from Dusty?
Yes.
You know where he defended the next night?
I do.
Where's it?
In Bacon County, Georgia. He said, who the heck booked this town here? I said, I did.
What the town you were running on? Or you were running the journal?
Nah. Yeah,
Quitman?
No, I ran Pavo one time and had him there right after he won it.
Yes, sir. He's been in a lot of these small towns. But he was a hot man because he had
quite a bit. So, and Dothan would be considered a small town compared to most of them. But Briscoe worked in Dothan quite a bit, worked in Mobile quite a bit. The smallest town that I know of in this territory that he worked in was, where was it? Crestview.
Who, Briscoe?
Briscoe. He wrestled Jerry Miller. Probably the bowling alley.
That's just part of the deal, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was part
of it. I remember one night in Savannah, Funk wrestled. He wrestled an hour of Broadway. I refereed it. The night it was over with, he said, can I borrow your car? I said, yeah. So why went on back to the hotel. We all stayed at the hotel down on by the river.
The town motel.
And so I looked out the door about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I see a bag in front of somebody's door. So I get up, I go down there, and it's Doors bag and the belt, world champion belt. And so I knocked on the door, and I said, Dory, Dory. Some guy stuck his head out of the window. He said, ain't no Dory here. Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. I'm sorry. So I picked up the bag and the belt, and I carried it back to my room. So the next day, Dory come to my room. And he said, Charlie. I said, yeah. He said, Musty's going to kill me. I said, why? He said, I lost the belt. I don't know why I did, but I lost the belt. He said, he's going to kill me. I should have kept that belt. You know what? I'd been worth some money today, shouldn't it? I said, no, Dory, I got it. I got your bag, too. He was like, my neck. That boy, you're going to break my neck. Get that bag, the belt, run out. And I've refereed a lot of champions.
I bet you.
How about Wild Bill Lawson? Y'all remember him?
No, I knew Lawson. He's a good guy.
Lawson was a good wrestler, too.
Yes, he was. Who was the first title match you refereed?
Oh, me?
Yeah, the world champion.
The first one. I think it was with Lawson. Who was the...
Lawson was a champion in the 40s, Charlie. You know, I know we knew you about being old there.
Who Lawson was?
He's not that old. Yeah, he was a champion
of World War II. I'm telling y'all, when the Lord said, let there be light, Charlie threw the switch.
What about Benny Kaminsky I refereed for him?
Well, that was the next
time. I've seen him in the ring.
Lawson?
Yes.
Of course, Kaminsky won the championship in 66, and I think... Bobby's told the story before, and Charlie, I know you're aware of it too, where he had the match with Tim Woods in Atlanta, and that was after the guy down
Friday
in Columbus,
after the finger off, episode in Columbus.
Yeah.
Garibaldi refereed that one. I was a kid sitting on the second row at ringside, and I remember that like it was yesterday.
and Brett Bobby.
Konitsky and Tim Woods.
Oh, yeah.
There again, nope, you know, nope. I mean, you go back, and they're just common sense. I mean, if you're the world champion and you're wrestling a guy and the guy's got his finger bit off 2 days before and the guy's capable of beating you for your title, what are you going to do? You're going to go after that finger, are you not? That's just
exactly.
Common sense.
I bet that thing was still pounding, too.
I bet it was, too.
Well, that just shows you, you know, that Tim Woods, he worked after that. He worked after that plane crash that Sean,
yes,
I call it. Yeah. You know, he didn't let anybody know he was on that plane. Didn't
yep.
take any time off because that would draw suspicion. And he worked after that. Just tells you what kind of person Tim Woods was.
Tim
was up at Kaminsky, didn't you? I was up at Dean Silverstone's Jippy Jether one time, and Lou Pez's wife was there, Charlie. And I thought she was somebody else, and I grabbed her, and I hugged her neck, and I turned around. Excuse me, don't tell Lou I did all this. I'm running hide. And I hugged Charlie's neck. And I said, Lou ain't looking, is he? She was a nice lady, too.
Yeah, she was. Jerry, did you hear what I asked you?
What's that?
Did you ever work with Kaniski? I know you didn't for the championship, but did you ever wrestle?
We did. No. Never did.
He was known to be as big as he was because you think... Back when you know, in the mid-60s and late-60s when he was champion, you know, it was unusual for somebody to be his size because he was, what, 6'5", 6'6"?
Yeah, he's a big man.
To be that agile, of course, he had played football and he wrestled amateur. So there again, if you look at the pattern going back, every one of these guys that carried the world championship, and again, that was one of the qualifications for being an NWA champion, you had to be able to guard against a possible double cross and be able to actual wrestle. I mean, probably the least of all the guys that carried the belt as far as the wrestler, but he could take care of himself too. I'm sure with Buddy Rod.
That would be correct, I would imagine. Him and Rich.
Well,
you know, long ago when you gentlemen were talking about Bob Winkle, he was on my line cussing me out. I said two great big old boxes out there at his house last week. They weighed 100 pounds apiece with T-shirts in them. And he called me up and cussed me out about picking them up. I said, Dick, thank you a lot.
He probably won't see those.
He's already going to have the police waiting on the plane when you and Bobby land out there.
You ain't lying.
He's another super nice guy, gentlemen.
Charlie.
Yeah.
I know we're this is away from the champion thing, but take a couple of minutes and tell Jerry the story about the watch that Nick sent you from Japan.
I asked Nick went to Minnesota when he left Georgia, and he called and he said he was going to Japan. I said, Nick, how about getting me a watch, a Seiko? He said, okay. I guess about a month later, mail came to the office, and I had a box, and I opened it up. It had Kotex. It had Tabasco sauce. Lemon cheese, you know. Oh, it was horrible. And the watch was, well, the watch was in the bottom of it. But it was awful smelling stuff. The Kotex was all red and everything. I was sitting there. They called me up. Did you get your watch? Yeah.
He told me that
was horrible.
Nick told me the story last year about that, and he said, well, he said, you got to remember, he said, I thought it should be wrapped appropriately for the person it was going to, and he said, that was just the way I thought it should be wrapped.
Well, ain't no worse getting the tongue. Yeah, ain't no worse getting the tongue through the mail, oh, is it?
Well, I heard that, brother. Anyway, that's another story.
Yeah. Well, gentlemen, I'm fixing to get off the line here. I enjoyed talking to you. Bobby, I'll see you Saturday.
Thanks for calling. I'll see you early Saturday morning, sir.
Yes, sir. Jerry, take it easy, sir.
Hey, watch out.
Michael, you too. You too, Mike.
See you, man.
So we were talking about Kineski, and then you guys remember when Dory Funk Jr. beat the date when Funk Jr. beat Kineski for the world title?
In Toronto, wasn't it?
No, that
it was in Tampa.
Maybe.
It was in Tampa.
He beat him in 69 in Tampa for the National Wrestling Alliance World Heavyweight Championship, but he had actually beat Dean Kineski in 1963 for the World Championship in Amarillo. And at that time, that was when Fez and Buddy Rogers had their little schmoz in Montreal, and Rogers was being recognized by some promoters as the world champion. Fez was by the other world, you know, other promoters as world champion. Amarillo, which I don't know if Funk Sr. had started actually running Amarillo at that time, but he was certainly a part of the office down there, and Dory was, you know, a year, maybe 2 years into the business by that point. But they brought Kineski in, claiming the world championship, and he put over Dory, and Dory won the world championship from him in 1963. And he only held it for a few months, and then they kind of phased it out and then had him lose a match to Fez to, I guess, decide it as a unification. But I thought that was an interesting piece of trivia that the two of them had actually wrestled for the championship with the same result 6 years earlier than the official one. But yeah, Funk beat him in Tampa in 69. I guess Dory was the last of the long-term champions because he held the title for 4.5 years. And then there again, you know, the story goes along that he didn't want to drop the title to Briscoe, and that's why they agreed to have Harley be the transition champion with the promise of him getting, you know, a longer run later on. Now, Bobby, I know you worked. You referee matches between Funk Jr. and Briscoe. Who was champion at that time?
Briscoe was the champion when I refereed those matches. Those are without a doubt the best matches I've ever been involved in.
But I've seen some of them.
I mean, I've been in some. I've worked with a lot of great people. I mean, there was very few. There was very few people in this business I could be in contact with I didn't like. But those two guys, I mean, they worked together so much. After Briscoe won the title from Harley, Funk Jr. and Jack worked so much, they didn't even call spots. They just knew what each other was going to do. I mean, it was the darndest thing I'd ever seen. And all I had to do was stay out of the way.
Now, Jerry, what was your first world title match?
Jack Briscoe.
In Kansas City, of that territory?
Right. Then
what
I worked
would you like for
Jack. Great. I thought he was unbelievable. The only time I ever worked with Dory, I always wanted to get in the ring with him. And the first time, and the second time, was all in Japan. That's the only time I ever wrestled him. In Japan, and I was in awe of him. To me, he was the best world champion ever. He never threw a punch. Everything he did was solid. It was believable. He had that timing. I mean, he. That's just my opinion.
You talking about Dory?
Yes,
I agree. Everything he did. To the average person, he looked slow. He was just very methodical. He was like a machine. And everything, and one thing about him, you could work with him three or four nights in a row, and you'd never see the same match.
No, sir.
Just very methodical, went about his business, and he just, yeah, everything he did meant something, and he was always thinking. Everything he did, always he was, you know, the next step tied into whatever he was doing. It was just, he conducted and carried himself very well. I agree. He was. Of course, the era you're talking about. I never was in a ring with Konitsky. I did meet him one time, but Konitsky, Harley, Dory Jr., Jack. This era we're talking about right here. Those guys were all. I mean, they were what the champion was supposed to be.
Exactly. Right. I never saw Barry Funk Jr. do anything off the wall. A goofy in that ring, ever. Never. It was all business. And, you know, people, until you got in the ring with him, you didn't realize how big Dory was. Big bone, raw bone, strong, and he could go all night long.
Which is adaptability. He could work anybody's style.
There you go. He
turned around to where it was his style. He controlled it. And Harley was a lot like that, too. Harley worked a lot of the same, you know, he tended to fall into a pattern where he hit the same spots. And that's something I never saw, like you were just saying, and Bobby was just saying, I never saw Dory do that. Dory's matches were always different because he was always adapting to who he was working with. And that's, there again, guys, what people don't realize, that especially ones that have you know, grown up watching wrestling for the last, say, 20, 25 years, was the world champions like Dory and Briscoe and Race and all of them that travel to these different territories, they work with guys that they've never seen before.
Oh, yeah.
Had never been in the ring before. And it was their responsibility in order to do what the promoter was bringing him in there for. No matter how good that guy he was in the ring with, he had to make a match out of it. And the best example of that is when during Harley's second run, he had to work an hour of Broadway in Nashville with George Gulas. He like, they're trying to carry me for an hour. A decent match out of it.
Bobby was talking earlier about, you know, the traveling that the champs did. I know Dory had held that belt probably at least two years. And when he got it, he had no time off. And I know they had promised him, Mushnick had promised him he'd be off on this Christmas night. And, you know, because his wife was all over him, said, if you're not home this Christmas, I'm leaving. Well, you know, I would have handled that myself. But then, yeah, he promised him he would be off Christmas night. So he made arrangements with his family. I'll be home. It was hard for him to get home because he lived in Amarillo. It was hard to get home late at night. You know, not like in Atlanta. You can get in and out of Atlanta anytime. So,
right.
The Christmas week, they called him and they said they had to have him somewhere. He said, I can't do it. He said, I'm telling you, I can't do it. I cannot do it. They got back with him. They called him back. They said, you tell your wife, you make this shot, you can have a week off, and we'll fly you to Hawaii and your wife. She went for it.
I'll tell you something else about Dory. You know, you were talking about he never threw a punch or anything, and this is just something I was sitting there thinking about. You know, when a champion would go in and he would be working against the top babyface in a territory, naturally he assumed the heel's role.
Right.
And, you know, most guys that assume that heel's role, they immediately want to resort to pulling hair, trunks, gouging eyes, you know, doing whatever they can to get heat. He never did any of that. He would work basically a scientific, and all of a sudden he'd get a little opening, buddy, and he'd hit him with a forearm.
You know, I never saw him pull anybody's trunks.
No, never, never. He would just, he would sneak that shot in, or maybe, you know, get a little rough on a four count before he broke, but he would get his heat that way. He never, you know.
Did you ever, either one of you guys ever work with him?
I never worked with him. I was just in the ring. I refereed some matches, but I never worked with him.
Let me tell you something. That forearm, that wasn't no joke.
You talking about that one where he come under, where he come underneath?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You better have your teeth shut. You like
somebody.
You think you're a man.
I worked with Tony Charles, and he did the same thing, and he wrapped your teeth with it, too.
Man, good. He, to me, if anybody said, who's the epitome of what they did, his name is at the top of the list on my list.
Yeah.
And I guarantee you, he had less time off than any champion. I go back.
For 4 years and 3 months, so you know that was a long time.
That was a long time.
But he was drawing too, and that's the thing is a lot of people, you know, current fans and stuff. When people talk about Dory Funk Jr., they talk about how boring he was, how he couldn't talk on the microphone, and well, he drew money for 4.5 years. That was when it meant something, and that to me says more than anything. That's why he was the champion for 4.5 years, because of his adaptability. And what Bobby was talking about, you know, how he worked, you know, he really didn't do any heel thing. And Jack Briscoe was the same way, at least from what I saw. Briscoe came in here. He was in here more than anybody, any other champion, and because I guess this territory was so close to Tampa. I saw probably 2 or 3 matches with him and Ken Lucas that were the same way, you know, clean scientific match until somewhere late in the match, you know, Briscoe take a shot on when he's supposed to be breaking on the ropes. Then at the same time, when he'd come in here and work with Tarzan Baxter, who was working as pro, which Baxter was a heel, so those would be all-out brawls, you know. They'd be tearing at each other from the get-go. And so, there again, you know, Briscoe carried himself just like Dory did. He could adapt so well. And of course, Jack, you know, he was during his run, I guess, was when the tendency to start hot-shotting the title came along with the deal that he worked with Baba over in Japan, where he dropped the title for a week. And of course, that was done supposedly without the NWA's approval.
That was some serious heat.
That was brokered by Terry Funk. That whole deal, of course, Jack pocketed $10,000 in cash.
Yep.
He had to hide in his waistband of his pants coming to the airport. He said he was sweating bullets and they were going to pat him down.
But Bobby, getting back to Jack and Barry, I bet the first time you refereed a match, you was in awe, wasn't you?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, had to have been.
I mean, it was just...
You actually saw how we all should have been.
It was just everything was fluid. Everything was everything was believable, and it just, you know, like I say, all I had to do was stay out of the way, and it was hard sometimes for me. I'm still a fan, The only wrestling pictures I have hanging in my house, the only picture, I mean, I've got some things that's hanging up, but the only actual wrestling pictures that are hanging in my house is the center of a program, and it's Dory and Jack working and me raising Jack's hand. I mean, it's just, I probably refereed 6-7 of those matches, and they were just unbelievable.
Picture says it all, doesn't it?
Yep.
That picture says it all.
When was the Inoki Muhammad Ali thing? Was that in 75 or 76?
Well, it's one or the other. I couldn't tell you to be sure.
I have no idea.
I'm thinking it was 75, and I'm not sure if Jack was still champion at the time, but I used to live in Tampa every summer, I would go down there. I had an aunt and uncle that lived down there, and I'd spend every summer down there. And I went to St. Petersburg. They had the closed circuit of the Inoki Ali fight. They also had a fee from New York for the Andre Wettman fight, and they had Dory and Jack from Atlanta. I think it was from the Omni. They worked.
No, it was the old auditorium in Atlanta.
Auditorium?
Yeah.
They worked a 55-minute Broadway, and like I said, I don't remember if Jack was still champion. It may have been after he'd already dropped the title to Terry. I know it was in the summertime. I do remember that. But that was by far the best match on the card. And if Jack wasn't champion, there was nothing there as far as a reason for the match other than just two guys wrestling each other. And just what a great match. Were you there, Bobby?
No, we actually ran a spot show that night. It's funny. I don't know why I remember this, but I was in Cornelia, Georgia that night. At the Habersham County High School. I have no idea why I remember that, but I do. Because I remember we got through with our show and I came back through Atlanta and the auditorium, they had broke up. The matches, of course, was over, but I stopped to see how the thing had went because I was curious what they were going to do with the Inoki Ali thing. And I don't even remember who was on the card, but I know I wasn't at the auditorium that night.
That's all you remember.
And then, of course, after Jack was Terry Funk, and Terry was totally different from Dory. He could work a match, he could wrestle a match, but he was a little bit wilder and did some goofy things in the ring.
He won the title in Miami. On a Wednesday night, I wrestled him the next night in Kansas City. Terry.
Was it a title match?
Huh?
Was it a title match?
Yeah, because it was on the books for me to wrestle
Briscoe.
Briscoe, exactly.
What was he like to work with in the ring?
Who, Terry?
Terry, yeah.
Well, I'm hard of hearing in one ear from it. He put a hole in my. I swear he did. He left. He loved it. What'd you say? No, he did, really. But no, he was. Oh. A little reckless. But.
That's a good word.
I mean, really. Terry didn't care, you know. I mean, he. I don't know, we was. I had wrestled him 3 weeks in a row in Kansas City. And the week before we won the title, I beat him he had that international title, which he had gotten in Japan, and I beat him for that. Then the next week, the winner of that match was going to wrestle Briscoe. But I beat Terry that night, and of course, the next Wednesday, he's in Miami, he got the world title, and he comes back. I'm going to wrestle the world champion that happens to be him. But, yeah, I mean, my gosh. I love Terry Funk to death, don't get me wrong. But he was all over the place, man. That's just the way, that was his style. That's the way he was.
As methodical as Dory was, you had no clue what Terry was going to do.
You know why? He didn't either.
He didn't either. He told me one time, and here I was, it's funny how you remember these things. I was at Savannah. And he told me he was working with Abdullah, and he had Abdullah out on the floor, and he told me, he said, Bobby, he says, grab me around the waist and push me back toward the center of the ring. Well, okay. So I grabbed him around the waist, and I was pushing him back from the ropes, and the next thing I know, I'm straight up, and my feet are straight up by the lights, and I'm being suplexed right in the middle of the ring. For somebody I've ever been suplexed in my life, and I'm like, I'm hanging upside down, and he's whispering in my ear. He goes, "You okay?" I said, "Well, I better be."
It was just something else.
you know, and you know, you think about it, I know Renesto, I remember Renesto laughing at me, you know, and back then a suplex, if you got suplexed, you were pinned.
Right.
Well, I'm the referee, so I figured if I'm suplexed, I got to be toted out, you know, so I just laid there. And then, I mean, it was, but you know, we talk about how Dory carried himself.
Right.
We were running Savannah on Sunday afternoons at 3 o'clock, and we would fly in there. Barnett was paying trans where we could fly because we didn't have any days off at the time. And we flew in there, and I was sitting there. There was a Hilton Hotel right next door to the Civic Center.
That's correct.
And I walked over to that Hilton, to the coffee shop. It was early. And I walked in, and Rock Hunter was sitting over in the corner. And I asked Rock, I said, you mind if I sit down with you? And he goes, no, not at all. We were sitting there in the corner. And Dick Slater and Terry Funk and somebody else came in. And we were in the corner, and we were watching them. And they come in, and there was a tray of Danish sitting right by the door under a little glass lid. He picks the, now, this is the world champion. He picks the lid up. He cuts the Danish in half, puts half the Danish in his mouth, and then puts the lid back on there. And he just walks over and sits down, you know. Well, the lady that was the hostess, she went over and got the other half and put it on a saucer and took it to him. She said, well, you bought this. You might as well eat the other half. And I remember Rock Hunter looking at me, and he goes, that's a heck of a way for the world champion to conduct himself, isn't it?
Well, I can talk about that one. When Dory was the world champion, Terry was in Florida with him, and Junior's wife had flown down there. So after the matches, they're checking into a hotel there in Tampa. Dory's up there checking in. There's a big fountain in the lobby. While Junior's signing in, Terry picks his wife up and throws her in the fountain. Junior looked around and saw that, and he saw how mad he was, so Terry jumped in there with her. Future world champion.
Oh, God.
Mm. And of course, after Terry came Harley, and that's when the title really started getting hot-shotted. I mean, in the space of Harley winning back in 77, between there and 81, he dropped it to Dusty once, Baba twice, and to Tommy Ridge before winning it again in 81. And I think this is a good opportunity. Bobby, I know you're tired of talking about it. You've talked about it plenty of times, but the rumor still persists out there, no matter how you tell people about Tommy Ridge and why he won the world title. And want to get it put on record as to why Tommy Ridge became the world heavyweight champion.
The board of directors agreed to let Tommy Ridge have the title for 5 days, actually for 4 days. He won it on a Monday night. He lost it on a Friday night. And he won it in Augusta there at the Bell Auditorium. And he had no idea he was getting the title till he got there that night. Jerry is the one that reminded me. I was thinking Ole was the booker, but it wasn't. It was Robley.
Exactly.
I think Robley knew about it because he, of course, Barnett had told Robley. I knew about what was going to happen because I'm the one that those telegrams you'd see in the programs all over the country when the title changed hands, those were shoots because I was the one that would call Western Union and send out all the telegrams, and I was sitting by my phone waiting on Barnett to call me to tell me it was over to send the telegrams. And it was done as a favor to Barnett to give Tommy credibility as our top babyface here. And that's the only reason it was done. You know, and God love him, he wasn't smart enough to capitalize on it. And I'm not sure he was capable of capitalizing on it. Maybe that wasn't his fault, but it was just that's the only reason it was done.
This is a question I always wanted to ask, Bobby.
Yeah.
Were those bookings? He went to the Carolinas for a shot or two, didn't he?
No, sir. No, sir. He worked right here all week. He worked Macon on Tuesday. He worked Columbus on Wednesday. He worked Rome or Athens, I don't remember where, on Thursday. and he dropped it back to Harley in Gainesville, Georgia, at the Gainesville Civic Center in front of about 350 people on Friday night. He never appeared on TV with a belt. Never appeared on TV with a belt at all.
To
it
me,
only, it was told about it. It was never. He never, you know, got on there and said, "Hey, I'm the world champion." Never happened.
To me, that hurt him more than helping him.
Yeah, could have. Barnett was good to me. Barnett was very smart, but I agree with you. The credibility factor, if he won it one time and he only held it for 4 days, on one hand you say, well, he beat the world champion. On the other hand, you say, well, it was a fluke because he couldn't keep it.
He couldn't keep it, exactly.
He couldn't keep it. And he never, you know, it was just one of the things I think that was a stipulation to him winning it was he would not go on our TV show in Atlanta with that belt.
Is that right?
I don't know that to be a fact, but it just makes sense to me that if I'm on the board of directors of NWA and you're doing this as a favor to promote your babyface and whatever, you know, for however, that TV was too strong to have him on there saying, hey, I'm the world champion.
Exactly.
And plus, you know, we've mentioned this earlier in the show tonight. You know, Michael, you mentioned about the fact you had to protect against a double cross, you know, being the champion. Not only did you have to protect against a double cross, you had to protect against that construction worker that's seen you walking down the street on Peachtree Street in the middle of the afternoon that says, hey, man, I think you're the world champion, and I don't think you can beat me. Well, you better be able to beat that construction worker. You know, or you lose all credibility and your business loses credibility. So that was another thing, is you had to be able to take care of yourself no matter where you were or how it came up. And let's face it, if Tommy had been approached or by some guy on the street, he couldn't have protected it.
No.
Yeah. I absolutely agree with that. And then after Tommy, you know, a month later, Harley's got it. A month after that, Dusty's got it. A month after that, Flair's got it. So it really started bouncing around. It showed a little bit of stability when Flair got it, because he went 2 years, and he did a phantom drop. He dropped it to Carlos Colon, which was never on the records. Dropped it to Victor Jovica or whatever they got. No, Venables, I think it was a guy's name that ran the Dominican Republic. You know, he dropped it to him and got it back. He dropped it to Harley and switched it with him twice. Once in St. Louis and once in New Zealand. And then finally he dropped it to Kerry Von Erich. And Kerry Von Erich had it three weeks, and Blair won it back in Japan. And I think that was the last time that the champion actually traveled. By that time, Jim Crockett was the president of the NWA. Of course, Blair, after all his years working for the Crocketts, you know, in my opinion, and you guys may feel differently, but in my opinion, by 1984, the NWA Championship had become a cup title. It was Crockett's, and that was it. It was defended against Crockett's guys, and the champion didn't travel anymore. I know that was one of the reasons that Ron Fuller pulled out of the NWA and started recognizing Nick Bockwinkel, and had Bockwinkel coming to the Southeastern and Continental show, is because he couldn't flare anything.
But Flair, to Garvin?
What's that?
He dropped it to Garvin, too. Flair did.
He did Garvin, but Garvin was working for Barnett. It was not like, you know, he was a territorial champion. By that time, it was World Championship Wrestling, and that was it, you know. It was all Barnett's company. You know, the guys that he switched with, Garvin, Dusty, they were all, you know, working for Jim Barnett. It wasn't like, you know, he went to, say, Portland and dropped it to Roddy Piper or anything like that. You know, that to me is when it became a company title and quit being recognized. He quit going to Japan.
Exactly.
And so that to me killed it. And that's no knock on Ric Flair. Ric Flair, because for, you know, for the better part of 2.5 years, he did travel. He traveled an awful lot. He probably traveled when he and Harley, they hit places that none of the rest of them did. I know Harley wrestled in Singapore quite a bit. Blair wrestled in New Zealand and Australia, you know, all over the place too, and the Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico and places that, you know, the champions didn't normally go prior to him. So it was a good thing, but then, you know, it became what it became when Crockett more or less became the NWA. And, you know, Jim Crockett Promotion became the NWA.
Well, the NWA had started losing its foothold. It had started losing its glitter. The promoters had had time, you know, Barnett had started running the tours up north. Not a lot of people were saying it out loud, but promoters were scared to death that we were going to take this TV in Georgia and we were just going to start doing what McMahon's doing now. And we could have. I mean, we could have. We could have run all over the country. But, you know, Barnett was just basically we were running the Sheik's territories. We were running, you know, the Detroit area and the Ohio area and the West Virginia area. But the NWA, as we had known it growing up and as beginning when we first got into business, it was going away. The territories were dying. McMahon was already working underneath he wasn't overt in what he was doing, but he was already starting to see what he could do as far as spreading out and branching out, and you know, it was just, it was a matter of time at that point. And you're right, he did quit traveling, but there wasn't a whole lot of places he could go anymore because they were just, you know, the promoters weren't working together like they used to.
How many world champions did you wrestle with, Jerry?
You mean when they had the belt?
When they had the belt, yes, sir.
Jack was the first one. Jack. Harley. And Rick.
And Terry.
And Terry, yeah, Terry.
So out of those three, or out of those four, who did you enjoy working with the most?
Out of those four, would have been, that's close. Harley, Jack, Terry, and Rick.
Why Harley?
We just clicked. I just had great matches with him.
You could have a great match with anybody. I've seen you work
on that. I appreciate that, but I hate to really say that because I enjoy the few times I did work with Jack, but I worked with Harley a lot more, you know.
Yeah.
And, I'll tell you what kind of person he is. I don't like talking the business too much on the radio, but what the heck. I was the North American champion in Louisiana. You know, we ran Oklahoma, Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas. So we was a TV in Shreveport, and Harley's a world champion. So we're all there, and Watt says, you will work today with Harley. Okay, you know what that means. Even though I got the title out there, so Harley called Watts outside. He said, let me, can I talk to you outside? And I said, oh, shit. Excuse me. I said, it's supposed to happen here. So the referee comes to the Watts wants to see you down the hall. I said, okay. And I get down there, it's Harley and Watts. And Watts says, hey, Harley's a world champion. He said, Harley wants to put you over on TV. I'm going, woo. And we did. That's kind of businessman he was. Well, when he come back through there, man, I worked with him all over. a big title out there, you know. It meant a lot out there. And then I cut interviews. All my family's coming to New Orleans this Thursday night. You know, they've seen me beat Harley Race, and they know I have a chance of becoming the World Heavyweight Champion. I mean, and it worked. And it worked. That's the kind of businessman he was. And, I always thanked him for it. I mean, to me, that was special.
Common sense, my boy.
Yep.
You sit back and you just, you know, just pure common sense. What would he have gained if he had beat you on TV?
Nothing.
Nothing.
He was looking at dollars and cents.
Yes, sir. That's right. Today, these guys are out here working for $5 or for nothing, and they're killing themselves. And you look back to that. That was the bottom line with me and you. I mean, as much as we enjoyed it, the bottom line was going to the bank.
And you know, for him to have done that, it was a business deal on his part, but he did me a favor.
Yeah, sure he did.
I mean, it's, you know, it was a two-way street for both of us.
Yep.
And when Watts said that, I just stood there like, whoa. And I couldn't believe it. And he was not greedy in that ring, man. That man was as fair as you could ever be, you know. And he was a tough son of a gun, now, don't take me wrong. But he was a businessman. He worked hard and he was fair. I can't say enough about him.
I say this with no reservation. That's the meanest white man I ever met in my life. Or the baddest white man. Let me rephrase that.
Tell you something, man. No joke.
Cool.
That's why he can sign his autograph so well.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I've signed him many a picture.
But, you know, he was the type, I'll use the word gentleman. I never, ever, and I was around him a lot. I mean, I was around him a lot of different territories. And I never, not one time, ever saw him take advantage of anybody.
Nope.
I don't care. If it was a TV match, you know, he may not give them a whole lot because, you know, but I'm talking about somebody that was really green and didn't. I never saw him take advantage of a guy in that ring. Now, I've seen Brody do it many, many times. And, you know, I've seen other people do it, too. But I can give him that much credit. He never took advantage of anybody.
Well, it's like Bobby was saying, and like you were saying, he was a businessman. I mean, what good does it do taking somebody and just totally squashing them? We were selling the business as a competition, you know, and as a, you know, an actual sporting event. Well, I mean, yeah, sometimes the Ravens will beat the 49ers 32-3, but it's still back and forth, back and forth.
Exactly.
And so
I never understood that. I never did.
And it was smart business on the hard side. That same question to you, Bobby, as far as refereeing. I know you refereed a lot of title matches. What would you say, if you had to pick one match, what would you say was your favorite title match that you refereed?
Briscoe and Funk, without a doubt. Just simply for the beauty of what it was.
Yeah, I mean, that
may sound strange to people, but our business can be a beautiful thing, man, if it's done right.
If it's done right,
it's just, you know, I mean, it's those two guys knew how to do it right.
They knew how to do it.
Yep.
Well, all righty. Well, that brings us up to our Jerry Hope's Natural Products Name of the Week this week.
Here we go. Hold on, Bobby.
I made it easy for you guys. Tom Jones.
Love me some Tom Jones.
And he'd have got a thing, it's not unusual.
I'm not talking about the puppet man now.
Oh. Women throw their panties at him and stuff? Oh, wrong guy.
I don't know. Now, this one may have had some women throw their tantrums.
Yeah, it probably did.
That was around. Nice.
When I first came over to work for Barnett, him and Pork Chop Cash were a tag team. And got to work with him quite a bit. Nice guy.
Wasn't he a nice guy?
Yeah.
He worked hard in that ring too, buddy.
Yes, he did. Was he from Savannah?
He was from Savannah, Georgia. Yep.
That's what I thought. Something.
He broke in, though, with Santos, if I'm not mistaken.
You know, I never did know business. I never did know.
He broke in up there. He was using the name Bearcat Jones. Again, he was a knockoff. He was supposed to be, you know, a knockoff on Bearcat Wright. And Tom broke in back in the days when you came south. You couldn't work, but he couldn't work with a white guy. He had to work with somebody. In fact, the time he came through Mobile, he had Matt Jewell with him, the other Bearcat who became Bearcat Brown. And those two worked the loop here together.
When did he get the business?
Early mid '60s.
Had to.
I know he worked. He worked a lot for Bruiser in the Sheik, but he was the first one in, I guess you can consider Oklahoma, southern state. But he was the first to break Culliberry in Oklahoma. He and Tarzan Baxter formed a team in '67 or '68, and he did real well for McGirt for many years out there. And I don't know if he's still doing it, but as of just within the last couple of years, he was still running his own shows in Oklahoma City and had a school out there.
Is that right?
Yes, sir. He worked all the way up until early 90s, I think. One of the last territories to close down was Portland, and he was out there as Mr. Ebony under Hood. And I think he worked for Fritz doing that gimmick, too, under Hood.
So he's in Oklahoma City, huh?
He's, the last I heard, that's where he was. He was in Oklahoma City.
He was a nice man.
Well, I got one more caller I'm going to get on the line with, because I recognize this. I know he saw some John Bristol Ken Lucas matches. Let me get him on the line. Greg Brown.
Yes, sir.
Tell me about Sam Lucas and Jack Briscoe and Dothan.
Lucas and who?
Jack Briscoe.
Oh, I saw a few of those matches, man, back in the day. Classic battles, classic matches. Classic. Yeah, I saw a bunch of those.
Who do you remember was the first champion you saw, Greg, world champion in Dothan?
Yeah, I saw him when he came through. Let's see who else. I mean, because every time whoever came through, I mean, I was at the Forum Center, so if they came through, I saw them. I see, really. That's just how it was. But yeah, man, that place is, you know, it's my home, and that's one thing I hate. That I never got a chance to wrestle in the Farm Center. I wrestled at the Civic Center, but that was Farm Center.
Well, that place saw some matches now. I don't think it didn't.
They really did. They used to have a black guy would come in. He'd probably come in about 7:30, quarter to 8. Overall, big black guy. Ring that bell, shorty. But you could hear him all over the building. Ring that bell. 8:15, ring that bell. And, boy, that get everybody stirred up. But that place was always packed, man. I mean, every time I went, it was packed.
Let me give you my first night in the Farm Center in Dothan. Jerry Oates had brought me a pair of red and black boots from Japan.
I remember that.
I'd bought me a brand-new red, and I was actually wearing a butcher type outfit like Dickie used to wear, but I had a high waistband. I didn't wear them low waistband, and I had a red outfit with a black waistband, had them red and black boots, and Olivia Walker had made me a red and black ring jacket my first night in the territory down there. I'm on the opening match with Dick Dunn, boy, and I'm the best-dressed guy in the building. And I walked down the end of them bleachers, and I turned to go toward the ring, and they was having a horse show there the next day, and they'd been in there all day with a tractor and had tilled up that red dirt on that floor, and when I stepped off on that dirt, I sunk to my knees.
New boots and all.
New boots and all, Bubba. That was my first night there. I worked with Dick Dunn.
Dick Dunn.
Yes, sir.
I like Dick. Well, you were probably better off if they tilted that dirt up, because the first time I took a bump outside the ring on that, I slid 15 feet. I hated that building, because I always worked heel down there, and the heel dressing room, it was a men's room, was all it was. And you didn't have anywhere to sit out. There was two or three chairs that they put in there, and of course, you know, me being in the position I was, I always deferred to the top heels, which at that time were Ron Bass and Jimmy Golden was around, and Saito was there. And so I just kind of found me a corner and dropped my bag and just stood around. And there was this little tiny room and the shower, and that was it. They only had one shower in there, so you had only one person at a time could take a shower. And hot, Lord have mercy, that building was hot. Well, they opened that big roll-up door, but it didn't create much of a breeze.
Well, let me tell you something. I wrestled in a lot of buildings, in a lot of places. I mean, you're talking about the Omni, you're talking about the Convention Center, you're talking about wherever. Place had more atmosphere than place. I believe that's where I was from. It had the perfect atmosphere.
That's like Greg said, those people would start stomping and clapping at age 15. Oh, Shorty Turner. That was Rocky McGuire's right-hand man, Shorty Turner. He couldn't spell to save his life. He put people's names in the... Because the newspaper print on their little newspaper had whatever he sent them. And this was back before I got in the business. Back Ron Starr came through here. And I guess Shorty couldn't spell Ron Starr for weeks in the Dothan paper. They advertised him as Roto Stacks. And Ken Lucas, for years, they spelled his name Lucus. Lucas. I guess Shorty figured, well, fell out, spell it like yourself. Hey, no, Brian, Bob, did I even give you a copy of that clipping from your night in Dothan?
I don't know.
If not, I'll have to get a copy of it and email it, too.
All right.
I'll just spell your name.
Hey.
Well, guys, we are. What's that, Jerry?
Did they spell Bobby's name right?
Yeah, they did.
Yeah, plus one other match.
No, they actually spelled Bobby Silver against Dick Dunn. They had the paper called him Bob Simmons, and he was one of the Cajuns, I guess it was. They just said against a Cajun.
Yeah, you sent me a copy of that. That was Larry Latham. It was Bob Simmons versus a Cajun. I thought they were going to get some guy of the swamps. I didn't know what they were.
He wouldn't have to go far in Mobile to get one out of the swamp.
Oh, jeez.
Well, guys, as always, this has been fun. Greg, I appreciate you calling in.
Thank you.
And appreciate Charlie calling in. And we will do this again next week, guys, and see what kind of trouble we can get into.
All Well, guys, I'm due to land next Thursday at 6 o'clock back into Atlanta. So I'm leaving Saturday going out to the Cauliflower Alley Club. So hopefully
Bobby
I'll have some more stories. Yes.
Send me an email.
Well, I was going to tell you, and I'll tell everybody that happens to be on my mailing list, during our move at work, I lost all my email addresses. I mean, I don't know what happened to them, but they went away.
Right.
So I am I'm kind of at the mercy of hoping somebody can get a hold of me. I will get in touch with you one way or the other, sir, to get you back on my list.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. You're welcome. And again, remember me Saturday on the plane with all that Smith bunch, just in case we get, you know, the air marshals get us or something.
Bobby's flying Smith Airlines to Las Vegas.
Yes.
We all have fun.
We're looking forward to it.
I told Charlie, I'll tell you two, and you pass along to Gene and Janice, if any of you guys go to that pawn shop out there that they have on the History Channel, I want a Chumley T-shirt size 3X.
Well, if we go over there, we'll see what we can find.
All right, guys. We'll talk to you guys next week.
All righty. Have a good week, guys. Enjoyed it.
Good night, guys.
Good night.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, the latest news on pro wrestling and MMA, and more. GWH thanks you for your support.